Good afternoon. Thank you for joining our July 28th CMS COVID-19 office hours. We appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedules to join us today. This is Alina Chekai leading stakeholder engagement on COVID-19 in the Office of CMS Administrator Seema Verma. Office hours provides an opportunity for providers on the front lines to ask questions of agency officials regarding CMS's temporary actions that empower local hospitals and healthcare systems to increase hospital capacity, rapidly expand the healthcare workforce, put patients over paperwork, and further promote telehealth and Medicare. And while members of the press are welcome to attend these calls, we do ask that they please refrain from asking questions. All press and media questions can be submitted using our media inquiries form, which can be found online at cms.gov/newsroom. Any non-media COVID-19 related questions for CMS can be directed to covid-19@cms.hhs.gov. Please keep in mind the questions discussed on this call are general representative questions. Your specific circumstances may be different. Therefore, the information provided may not always be applicable to your unique situation. You are welcome to reach out to the COVID-19 mailbox for further assistance. And we'd like to begin our call today with some updates on CMS's latest guidance and publications. Last week, in our frequently asked questions document to assist Medicare providers, we updated the answer to a question raised several times on this call on the correct application of the CS modifier. The question is, how should the CS modifier, which removes application of beneficiary cost sharing, deductible, and copayment, be applied to telehealth services and/or E&M visits? The answer is, the CS modifier should be applied for certain E&M services related to COVID-19 testing, whether they are furnished in person or via telehealth. These services are medical visits under the HCPCS evaluation and management categories described when outpatient providers, physicians, and other providers and suppliers who bill Medicare for Part B services orders or administers a COVID-19 lab test, regardless of the HCPCS codes they use to report the test. Cost sharing does not apply for COVID-19 testing-related services, which are medical visits that are furnished between March 18, 2020, and the end of the public health emergency, result in an order for or administration of a COVID-19 test, are related to furnishing or administering such a test, or to the evaluation of an individual for purposes of determining the need for such a test. The answer then describes detailed updated guidance on the appropriate categories of HCPCS E&M categories for the CS modifier, online digital evaluation and management services for which cost sharing does not apply, and guidance for providers and suppliers that bill Medicare for Part B services. Also, please see the updated FAQ under the section Billing and Coding Guidance on our current emergencies page for the full text of the response. Also, last week we updated our guidance document 2019 Novel Coronavirus Medicare Provider Enrollment Relief Frequently Asked Questions. The updated FAQs can be found on our current emergencies page under the section Provider Enrollment Guidance. Additionally, the COVID toolkit for states to mitigate COVID-19 in nursing homes has been updated as of July 27th and can be found on the current emergencies page under the section Clinical and Technical Guidance for Healthcare Facilities. Finally, as you may already know, the public health emergency was extended last week for another 90 days. Operator, let's please open up the lines for questions. As a friendly reminder, please keep your questions to one question or one question and a follow-up today. Operator, over to you.
Okay. And at this time, if you would like to ask any questions, you may press star 1 on your telephone keypad. Again, that is star 1 on your telephone keypad. We will pause for just a moment to compile the Q&A roster. And your first question comes from the line of T. Faircloth. Your line is open.
Hi, thank you very much for taking my question. My question has to do with the expanded ability for hospitals to offer long-term care services, swing beds in big hospitals. On your notes, you give good protocols on how to handle internal transfers, i.e., patient is moving from acute care to swing bed within the same hospital. But what we're trying to find out is, are the protocols for transfer from one hospital to a hospital that is now offering the swing bed services separate hospitals? Are those protocols for their transfer the same as they normally are, or is there some sort of different transfer for hospitals that are have expanded their swing bed services?
I don't believe we have put out specific guidance on how we can address that circumstance, and we'll need to go back and confer with a couple colleagues.
Okay, thank you very. Who is this?
Yeah, this is Jason Bennett.
Mm-hmm. Oh, thanks, Jason. I appreciate it. What we're just trying to find out is if you're moving from, say, a smaller hospital. We have a smaller hospital that has expanded into offering swing bed services. They want to accept swing bed patients from overrun hospitals an hour away. But what we're trying to figure out is what's the right protocol. Do they use their normal protocol, or do they use some sort of enhanced protocol to transfer those patients? So that's it.
Do you mean protocol is in
for internal transfers, you have to
health and safety type of
what I'm talking about, what I'm talking about under qualification protocol, like right now for an internal transfer, you have to call a MAC and attest before you transfer them internally. You have to call the MAC and attest that there are no SNFs able to take care of this patient and we'll move them as quickly as possible, all these other their enhanced protocols. But if you're transferring them to another hospital that is set up using that, does that outgoing hospital have to make all those same, have to jump through all the hoops, or can they just transfer that patient like a normal swing bed patient?
Okay, yeah, that's what I thought you were asking. I think we have
not
been.
Does that make sense in terms of a question?
Yeah, I think we have not been specific on that because there's just the history of sort of what swing beds were intended to relative to the emergency. So I think we need to go back and be more specific.
Thank you so much, Jason. Appreciate it.
Yeah.
All right. Bye.
And your next question comes from the line of Kirsten Cope. Your line is open.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. This is with regards to the C9803 for specimen collection at the hospital outpatient clinic. I just wanted to inquire if it's okay to provide only the swab, just the specimen collection, no assessment with that. I know in a May 26 call you had answered with regards to the 99211, it was okay to just do the swab. And I just want to make sure that was also the case for the C9803. There's no expectation of any sort of nursing assessment to accompany that. And I'm wondering, do these two codes have to be priced the same? Do we have to charge the same for both of these?
I'll start with the first part of your question for hospitals. Unlike the level one E&M code in the office setting, the descriptor of the code is that it's a hospital outpatient clinic visit specimen collection for coronavirus or COVID-19, any specimen source. And so in order to bill for that code, you would have to meet that description. Can you clarify the second part of your question about which two codes are you referring to? In terms of payment?
So the 99211 and the C9803, both intended for specimen collection. Would the hospital be expected to set up the charge for both of those to be the same charge, depending on if they were done in the office setting or the clinic?
I don't think we have specific hospital charging guidance or protocols on that. I'm going to pause and see if anyone else on the call would like to address that question. If not, we can certainly take it back, but I'm not aware of any Medicare guidelines with respect to having charges be equal for those two different CPT codes. They're different codes and they describe different things, and so I'm not aware of any charging requirements or charging parity requirements, but we can certainly take that back.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
And your next question comes from the line of Terry Harmon. Your line is open.
Yes, hi, thank you. I appreciate you guys taking my call. My call is relative to the SNF regarding the point of care tests and the testing. Some of our centers, a few of our centers in some of our states have just received those. So my question is, I understand that we are getting these tests from CMS, the equipment itself, and then the first however many testing strips or cassettes that, you know, that it comes with. But there isn't anything that I have read regarding reimbursement of ongoing testing or ongoing screening. And my second part of that is, are these available to be used for flu testing? And if so, is there any type of reimbursement available for the flu testing?
Hi, this is Demetrius. I think I can try to answer some of this.
Thanks, Demetrius.
Your question with regards to the ongoing screening or evaluation, we do have an MLN article that we put out that refers to some guidance we gave our contractors around screening and other kinds of tests and diagnostic tests in the context of SNFs. And I don't, you shouldn't sort of rely completely on a high-level summary. Obviously, just look to the document itself, but it doesn't, it lays out some circumstances where we consider things to be diagnostic, but it doesn't change the fundamental rule that, you know, that things that are screening aren't things that we Medicare pay for. Provides a little bit of clarification around some circumstances where things, where a certain test could be diagnostic or would be diagnostic. And so I'd point you to that article. I don't know if you've if you need help finding it,
I do, because I haven't seen that.
Okay. We can. It's MLN number 20011.
Okay, 20011. 20011. Okay, I will look for that.
Okay, and then your other question is about flu testing and. Is it, are you sort of generally asking, is there anything new or different about flu testing this year that you ought to be thinking about? Is that
pretty much. But I was thinking is, could there be an opportunity to utilize this, the point of care, the machine, could we utilize that for the flu testing? Because I know that one of the machines has that availability. And so is that an option for us? One of the machines actually has five availabilities along with, well, four other than the COVID or the SARS. And so would that be something that the SNF could utilize for the flu testing? And if we do that, would that be reimbursable? Is there any reimbursement, you know, available for that diagnostic flu testing?
Okay. I think what I can say that might be helpful to you there is that there isn't a sort of a separate wrinkle or unique issue around the use of those particular machines. I think we're generally treating them like other tests. We do have some rules around circumstances where things are donated, and those may apply. But my point is really that there isn't sort of something specific to this distribution of machines or these particular machines. The question of, you know, whether clinically or otherwise it might be appropriate to use them, obviously I would defer to those far more expert than I in the public health or clinical questions about that. And then I think you asked a related question of, is it reimbursable? And I would say that there isn't, again, that there isn't a sort of a separate or unique rule that we've put out in any way around these, this particular distribution of machines, that we would point you to the general guidance we have around circumstances under which testing is reimbursable and the circumstances under which donated products or products that have been received free of charge can be used. And I don't think that there's an outright prohibition in those circumstances. There's some allowance for things like that, but you should look to the guidance for the particular contours.
Okay, I will do that. And I know it's very, very new. They're just now going out, but I thought since – and thank you very much for the assistance. And I will look up that article.
Okay, thank you.
And your next question comes from the line of Melia Adachi. Your line is open.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. My question is related to the guidance regarding S885 for nursing homes, which is informing residents, their representatives, and families of COVID activity in the nursing homes. Since we received the guidance on May 6th, I just want to clarify whether that, I know that we did the initial notification to all the residents, representatives, and their families by 5 p.m. the next calendar day. Now, my question has something to do with the subsequent cases. You know, am I understanding the guidance correctly that reporting or giving weekly updates is of the COVID cases is sufficient as per the guidance, or are we supposed to report every positive COVID case that comes up, any subsequent ones that comes up, by 5 p.m. of the next calendar day? Because we're getting different responses from different surveyors in different states.
This is Sarah, and I don't think that we have anyone on the line from the Division of Nursing Homes, but if you could send that question in, I will certainly make sure you get an answer to that.
Okay, so I should just, okay, I will do that. Although it's like, I guess it's in the, I thought it was very clear in the frequently asked questions, but somehow some surveyors in some states are interpreting it differently. So I'll just send that question. Thank you.
Thank you.
And your next question comes from the line of Nancy Reed. Your line is open.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. This is, I know that there was an update relative to the correct application of the CS modifier. However, we just want to clarify that just a little bit further. Would it be appropriate to add that CS modifier to an E&M for an outpatient visit where a COVID lab is ordered, so far we meet the reg, when the documentation indicates that the sole purpose of that visit was to test for COVID in advance of a surgical procedure, so essentially pre-procedure testing? So this would be for the safety of the organization and or other patients as opposed to the patient presenting symptoms.
Okay, and is your question about whether it's covered or how to code it if it's covered or both?
Sure, we'll go with both.
Okay. I think that we've been pointing folks to the MAC for pre-procedure testing. It's a question that has enough sort of coverage, context, and nuance to it that we want to have the MACs. We think the MACs are in the best position to answer it. And as to how to bill, I'll if it is covered, I'll defer to Tiffany if she's got anything to add to that.
Yeah, that's correct. If it's a hospital E&M code and it meets all the other terms outlined in the statute and the guidance, and as Demetrius just mentioned, the coverage piece is separate, but in the guidance that we've put out and that the law talks about, it doesn't say anything about the COVID tests, you know, being for pre-op reasons or for any other reason. It just mentions that the visit results in an order for or the actual administration of the test. And so that's sort of how the payment construct is set up. And so the pre-op testing coverage is a separate issue. And as Demetrius mentioned, it would be best to check in with your MAC on that piece.
All right. Well, thank you.
And your next question comes from the line of Angie Donovan. Your line is open.
Yes. My question is regarding the CR modifier. I'm trying to get clarification is if we're doing the 87635, which is the COVID test, along with the C9803, the collection, are we supposed to attach the CR modifier to both of those line items for hospital billing? Can you all hear me?
Yeah, I think that we lost our expert who can speak to that, but she's going to come back on shortly. Maybe we can take another question and circle back to this when she gets back on.
Okay, and your next question comes from the line of Jean Alley. Your line is open.
Yes, my question is when a provider is doing a telehealth visit, how specific does the documentation need to be for the patient's location? For example, is it enough to say that the patient is at home, or does the provider need to tell what state the patient is in or the patient's street address? Just how specific does that need to be?
Yeah, so for payment purposes, we have not provided any specific guidance as to the documentation requirements necessary to demonstrate the location of the beneficiary. I don't know if MACs might have individual guidance about that, and so I would sort of suggest that be a place that you could pursue this question further. But from a national policy perspective, we don't have any specific guidelines there.
Okay, thank you.
And your next question comes from the line of Aileen Lyons. Your line is open.
Thank you very much for taking my call, and thank you for having these calls. My question just revolves around codes 98966 to 98968. With the recent change regarding the registered dietitian, just want to make sure, is it still permissible for a psychiatrist, psychologist, social work, and all of the therapists, speech, PT, OT, to still use these codes?
Yes, they are still able to use those codes. That is correct.
Fantastic. Thank you so much.
Before we move on to the next question, just to circle back to the last questioner, I think the answer we've got is that if the COVID article that relates to the DR question is not doesn't include the answer, then we'd have you send it in. Diane, I don't know if you have more to add.
No, I don't have anything to add. I don't know the specific answer at this time. So, yeah, if you could send that in, if our article doesn't handle it, that'd be great.
And your next question comes from the line of Amanda Dayan. Your line is open.
Thank you very much. So, if I understand you correctly, you had just said that we potentially need to contact the MAC about pre-procedural testing. But I guess my question is, if the patient is coming in for the normal pre-op testing that they would normally get, and while they're there, the provider suggests they get the COVID testing done, or they end up doing it, technically the reason was not COVID-related to come in. Would that E&M end up getting the CS modifier?
I think really highlighting why we're sending these questions to the MAC, that there is a lot of context that can depend on the particular circumstances. I always feel a little shy about saying go to the MAC because it feels some people might perceive it as a dodge, but it's really, I think, just the kind of nuance you're now laying out that illustrates that there's a lot of some facts and circumstances to this, and so I would defer you to the MAC for that as well.
Okay, thanks. I do have a follow-up to that, if that's okay.
Sure.
My MAC has not issued any guidance on this thus far, and so is CMS going to try to relay to the MAC that they need to try to help the providers with this, or is it really strictly just upon the MAC to initiate and do this by themselves?
So we've been in touch with the MAC. I don't know if you feel like you're not getting answers or guidance that you need, then please let us know a little bit more about the question and the outreach you've had, and we'll see what we can do.
Perfect. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And your next question comes from the line of Rusty Stein. Your line is open.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call. I was hoping I could get a little bit more clarification in terms of the application that's required for patients' homes to be designated as provider-based. Is the requirement still that the patient's home address needs to be added to this application?
So this question is on the temporary relocation request for a provider-based department. Assuming you're asking about a department that you're looking to be accepted from Section 603, then in that case, yes, if the provider-based department relocates to the patient's home, then their relocation request for that location needs to include the address at which the service is provided, which in this case would be the patient's home. Just would note that, of course, that the provider always has the option of not seeking the relocation request to be accepted and providing the service and billing the PN modifier as a non-accepted service. So that would be the sort of the choice there.
Okay. Thank you. I appreciate that.
And your next question comes from the line of Annie Horace. Your line is open.
Hi. Thank you so much for hosting these calls. My question is in regards to FQHC services. If we provide two telehealth services on the same data service, like a medical and behavioral health visit, is it safe to assume that we should be using two G2025 codes? And if we do, do we add a 59 modifier? And does it matter if we add it to medical as opposed to behavioral health or the other way around?
So hi there. I think that generally, even pre-pandemic, two visits could be billed. And there is a modifier, unfortunately. I'm not sure if 59 is the absolute correct modifier. I don't have that guidance in front of me. But sort of the telehealth rules did not change that. So if two visits that are separate and distinct, you know, according to the guidance we have pre-COVID-19 and telehealth, that is still applicable.
Great. Thank you so much. I really appreciate your help.
And your next question comes from the line of Jim Collins. Your line is open.
Yes, thank you. So my question is about the remote physiologic monitoring treatment management, and I'll just narrow it down to two codes, the 99457, which is the first 20 minutes of management services, and then the 99454, which is the equipment rental, basically. What I'm wondering is if these two services, the management service and the rental service, if it's okay to uncouple those. So, you know, one scenario would be we provide the patient with a weight scale, blood pressure cuff, pulse oximeter, and they go home and they don't ever transmit data. Can we still bill the monthly rental fee even though we're not getting the data? And then the flip side of the uncoupling is if the patient provides their own equipment, like their watch, they purchase a weight scale, blood pressure cuff, pulse oximeter off of Amazon for $60 for all three of them, basically. Can we still provide the monitoring, the management service, even though we're using equipment that the patient brought to the equation? So just wondering if it's okay to uncouple those in both directions.
Yeah, so I think that you will need to send that question in so that we can get an answer to sort of the specifics of what you're asking. However, just sort of a general rule with CPT coding in general, in order to report the CPT code, one needs to have furnished the service as described by the CPT code. And so instances where a portion of that service is not actually being where the equipment, for example, that is described in the code, and I have to confess that remote physiologic monitoring is, I'm not as familiar with those policies, but if, you know, if the code descriptors or the CPT preparatory language indicate that the equipment would needed to have been provided in a certain way, then that is the way that it would need to be provided in order to bill for the service. However, I would, again, suggest that you submit that specific question to us so that we can get you a more fulsome answer.
Yeah, it's just CMS, you know, nationally is acting like MACs when it comes to this particular service. They're not answering any questions. One of the CMS representatives told me because of the Allina Health lawsuit that Medicare has kind of a gag order against answering questions without first publishing them and then letting people comment. But these services have been out for 2 years. The codes have been, and there's been zero answers from Medicare, and the MACs don't even, you know, they're, as you're hearing on the last couple of calls, MACs are not doing their job. They're not answering questions. They're not clarifying gray areas. It's really frustrating. It's like these services, these physiologic monitoring, they have the potential to have a huge positive impact on both patients and the cost of their care. But a lot of people are afraid to do them because the numbers don't add up. I can buy a Bluetooth scale for $10, give it to the patient, and then Medicare will pay me $62 a month for providing that $10 scale to the patient. It doesn't add up. I'll send in the answer or the questions. There's about 20 of them that I've been trying to get answered. But it's one of those things where there's a void being created, a vacuum. And I think there's a lot of opportunity for people to take advantage of the system. And then the last thing is not a question, but a comment is the question about the CS modifier being applicable to patients receiving the lab test because of hospital policy. That was actually addressed on the May 5th conference call, the May 5th office hours call. And it was a positive answer that yes, you know, if it was specifically said there, if there is an order for the COVID test, in this case, because it's the hospital's policy, that was given as an answer to that it is appropriate to use a CS. So I'll just throw that in there for the previous caller.
Fair enough. And the calls are posted online, so if we don't always have the same mix of people who can answer everything, then that's available as a resource too. I'll also say I understand sort of some of the frustration around guidance and the like. Obviously, that's something that we're always working to improve. There, I will say on RPM that there is a host of sort of questions that have been kind of out there for a while over the last year or maybe longer that we have answered in the FAQs. I'd refer you to those. I think that there's some overlap between some of the questions you're raising and the FAQs that we have answered, even if it's not absolutely within the four corners of your question. But I think
okay.
you'll find that helpful. It's a question that relates to it reads something like the prefatory language for RPM CPT codes requires a device be used to capture a patient's physiologic data must be a medical device as defined by FDA. Can we assume that any device used to capture the data, it meets this requirement? And then there's an answer to that as well and some related questions too.
Okay. And where do I find that? Is that on the COVID-19 webpage or just on the general Medicare FAQ?
I think it's on the COVID-19 FAQs. Is that right, Tiffany?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
I'll get that. I appreciate it. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. And some of those questions, by the way, aren't specific to the public health emergency. They're more relevant in the context of the public health emergency, but a number of the RPM questions we answer sort of in the abstract, even outside the PHE.
Yeah, great. That makes sense. Thank you.
You're welcome.
And your next question comes from the line of Donna Riggs. Your line is open.
Hello. Thank you for taking my question. This question is about hospital-based clinics. As far as we're wondering about billing pulmonary rehab services via telehealth with the respiratory therapist overseeing the appointment. Will that work at hospital-based clinics billing pulmonary rehab with the respiratory therapist overseeing the appointment or the pulmonologist required for them to oversee? And is pulmonary rehab allowed as a telehealth service?
So pulmonary rehab is has a specific statutory provision associated with it. It's got some, for whatever reason, Congress legislated around it in a very specific way. So we know that this is an outstanding question, and we do think we have an answer, but it's not out yet, and we're working on it. I know that's not totally pleasing, satisfying, but do know that we know of the question, and we're working on trying to provide some clarity around or potentially make changes around when the service can be provided in a way that coincides with the current restrictions. I'll also just say more generally on some of these challenges, sometimes the reasons we take back the questions is because we want to find a way to a better answer than the one that we can give that sometimes can be very limiting. And so this is an example of that. This is something that we're working on, and we might be able to find a path to something that a construct that is more amenable to patient utilization and access, but it would require some internal work and obviously thinking through the statutory provision that I mentioned.
Okay.
I don't know if there's anything, Tiffany, you want to add from a Hospital Without Walls perspective?
Sure. I would just add that the direct supervision requirements in the statute
related to the pulmonary cardiac and intensive cardiac rehabilitation services. They do require that the care be furnished in the hospital. So to the extent that under the Hospitals Without Walls waivers that are in effect during the public health emergency are used and the hospital makes the patient's home provider base to the hospital for the provision of services, then it seems that that requirement can be met along with regulations that we adopted in as interim final that allow for direct supervision to be met virtually. So I can't speak to your question about who exactly the level of professional who can do the service, but in terms of the service needing to be performed in the hospital and needing to have direct supervision, I do think that those two aspects have been addressed by the Hospitals Without Walls provision.
Okay, that helps.
Okay,
all right, thank you.
And just to bring it full circle, so the other answer I was giving at the beginning really related to separate from the Hospital Without Walls construct, just as a matter of the ordinary benefit, if you will, what modifications or interpretations could be made about the circumstances under which it can be provided. So that's the part that's pending.
Okay. Thank you.
And your next question comes from the line of Emma Vander. Your line is open.
Yes, good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. I just had a quick follow-up, and you mentioned about the 99457 code. One of the criteria that the providers are looking to get some clarification is definition of interactive communication, and I was just wondering if there's any plans to issue that clarification. We're trying to build the appropriate documentation and process for that code, but the interactive communication seems to be one of the open items for CMS to resolve.
I see. Okay. Thank you for that. Thank you for that question and for flagging that for us. I think that this is another thing that we will definitely need to take back and consider further. So if you could send an email, that would be really helpful.
I did.
Thank you.
I did submit the email. All right. Thank you.
Okay, great.
And your next question comes from the line of Gina Ruiz, your line is open.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I had a follow-up question with regard to the G0463 versus Q3014. I saw that the FAQ was updated today, and so now there's clarification that if we register the patient's address as a temporary expansion location of the hospital outpatient department, and we're providing an E&M service where our physician is actually in the clinic, the patient is actually in the home, we're allowed to bill the G0463 because now it's a remote service and not a telehealth service. But the question is, since we are providing the patient's address as a temporary relocation area of our hospital, are we billing that G0463 with a PO modifier? And because it's being billed under waiver, are we also billing the CR modifier and the DR condition code on our UBL?
So, yeah, so taking the second part first, for any service provided at a location that has sought a temporary extraordinary circumstances relocation request, you would bill with the PO modifier to signify that it's accepted service, and as well as the applicable CRDR modifier to show that it is a service being provided under the waiver authority. Of course, as I mentioned before, there is the question of whether or not, going back to the first question, there's the question of whether or not it is something that's on the service that's on the telehealth service list and is being provided by a distant site provider. If that's the case, then it should be billed with a 95 modifier on the physician side and the originating site fee. If it's not one of those services, if it doesn't meet those circumstances, then it should be billed as the G0463, signifying that it's a remote hospital service.
Okay. So, I'm sorry, can you say, so I had sent a question in to the help desk and stating the patient is at home with a registered address, the physician is in our clinic. Should this be billed as telehealth with a 95 modifier? Because previous office hours calls stated that we should bill it a Q3014 for originating site. And the answer came back, no, you should bill that as a G0463 because it's a remote service and the hospital should bill it as they normally would. And then the FAQ was just updated today with a graphic that includes the decision tree, and it's section LL, hospital billing for remote services, question 3. And the answer is we should be billing these as a G0463. So that is what you're saying as well, right?
I'm saying you should follow the decision tree, and if the service is the kind of initial part of that decision tree is the service being provided by a distant site provider, and is the service being provided on the telehealth services list? If those are the case, then it should be billed with the originating site fee. If that's not the case, then it would be billed as a G0463 under as a remote hospital service.
Okay, and then we would be billing that with the PO modifier and the CRNDR.
Correct.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
And your next question comes from the line of Mary Gracie White. Your line is open.
Thank you very much. I appreciate these calls and all the great information. Actually, just trying to see if there is information available on the CMS CDC training that will be tied to funding, additional funding for nursing homes. Would that be the infection preventionist training? We have many members in New York who are asking that question. Someone can advise.
So I think the funding that you're talking about is coming from the Provider Relief Fund, and
yes,
that's not administered at CMS, but we can get your question to the right place.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Would that same place be where we can get information on point-of-care testing that's being made available and sent to nursing homes?
No, that's a different place. We can try to get to that question to that place, too. So the Provider Relief Fund is being run out of HRSA, the Health Resources and Services Administration, along with a sort of an interdisciplinary team that they've got supporting them as well. So that's a sister agency. The point-of-care tests, I believe, are being distributed either by ASPR, the preparedness and response folks, but under the working closely with the Assistant Secretary for Health. And I've just walked you through the HHS org chart probably, but so a lot of different players, but we can definitely route your question to the right place.
Thank you. And how will I do that follow-up? How can I? Is there an email or?
Yeah, Lena, you want to share
sure
that?
Thing. Yep, that email address is covid-19@cms.hhs.gov. And if we have any updates for you that would be helpful for a larger audience, we'll be sure to incorporate them in our top-of-the-call remarks next week as well.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
You're welcome. And we'll take our final question today. Thank you.
And your last question comes from the line of Jonathan Gold. Your line is open.
Yes, thank you so much for taking our calls. My call, a question has to do with The notice that was put out that contractor audits will continue and on August 3rd. And I just wanted to know if any further information will be put out about that, such as how a provider would claim a hardship exception for that if they're if they receive an audit request, or if there's any additional information you could provide. And thank you again for your time.
Okay, I don't know that there is a hardship exemption per se, but obviously there's always circumstances that ought to be considered, and it certainly is conceivable that there will be some situations where there is some kind of imminent crisis or access issue that is occupying the energy of the organization, and there's a desire or need for the MAC to work on a schedule that is, that accommodates that, reflects it. So I think that the MAC or other reviewer that is. So I think really the guidance I'd give you there is to, if you were to get an audit notice and you feel like there's a circumstance that requires an individual accommodation like that, that you let the entity that's conducting the audit know, and you can always also engage with our Center for Program Integrity. I don't know if any of our CPI folks have anything to add to that who might be on the call. Okay. I think not.
Great. Thank you for your question, and thank you, everyone, for joining our call today. Our next office hours will take place next Tuesday at 5 p.m. Eastern. In the meantime, you can continue to submit questions to our COVID mailbox. Again, that is COVID-19@cms.hhs.gov. This concludes today's call. Have a great rest of your day.